The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.
Okay, so welcome to the Secure in Mind podcast. I'm excited about this conversation that I'm about to have because it is with one of my former guests who I had the pleasure of meeting in Brussels and having a great discussion when she occupied a former role. And now she has moved into something even bigger and even better and even more challenging and even more sleepless, which would be hard to do based on the level of her previous job. Look, I'll introduce you to none other than Despina Spenu. Now, reading off her bio, Despina is the head of the cabinet of the Vice President of the European Commission, overseeing the European Union's policies on security, migration and asylum, health, skills, education, culture and sports. Now, as regular listeners of the show know, the genesis of this podcast was of a cyber flavor. However, over the 2 years or so that I've been recording, which is just crazy, it has expanded to incorporate more areas which are touched on or which have topic points about security and risk. And even last year, I interviewed Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's now in the media about immunological and pandemic issues. And of course, Despina and I will certainly jump into the COVID crisis head on. But look, I'll stop my perennial preamble. And introduce you to Despina. So welcome to the show again.
Pleasure to be back here again, Nick.
Excellent. We're both actually based in houses in other parts of Europe. Last time it was a bit easier to record. We were, in front of each other in the office, in your office in Brussels. Look, before we jump into some of the big topics, maybe update us on your change. Last episode, of course, where you were the director for DG Connect cybersecurity, e-voting, and a couple of other areas, which I can't remember off the top of my head. But what's changed? What's your new role in Compass? And then we can jump into the thick of it.
Thank you, Nick. So when we met, I was director for digital society, trust and cybersecurity. That was already a very big challenge to ensure mm-hmm. that in our digital society, we have the two pillars of security and trust together. My current job is not very far from that. It's just larger in scope. It is about what we call the European way of life. As you know, this is the title of the vice president that I have the honor to work with. Mm-hmm. It is the European way of life is all about making sure that people have security, that anyone who comes into Europe have the same opportunities and enjoy this European way of life. This is why migration and asylum are part of this portfolio. Mm-hmm. And of course, the European way of life is about a secure environment, but also a healthy environment. That's why it includes public health. And of course, when it comes to opportunities and integration, it is all about education, skills, culture, and sport, mm-hmm. the things that bind our society together. So this was the notion for the creation of this portfolio. And I am the head of cabinet of the vice president in charge of that. The Americans call it chief of staff. Okay. So I'm basically running his team.
Yep.
And I represent him within the European Commission for all the processes around the adoption of everything that the European Commission basically does.
Yep.
So this is what the role of the head of cabinet is. Of course, right now, all our work is turned around the management of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And my vice president being responsible for public health, you can imagine that indeed, as you said, we have many sleepless nights and very long days.
And it won't end soon, but there is light at the end of some tunnel somewhere.
For sure. That's what we've been working for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thank you very much for the description. It's a very wide-ranging brief, but I guess it's the glue of society. So, probably one of the most important briefs. Out of curiosity, and I thought this is quite interesting just to pick up on before jumping in. The use of the words, and I saw one of your colleagues about the change in wording. So nowadays, the European way of life is not protecting the European way of life, but it's promoting the European way of life. Now, I can absolutely see the sense in choosing that different terminology. Two questions on that. One question in particular regarding quantitative tracking measures. Are there actually any ways in which you can determine the influence of choice in terminology of a society? And second of all, the justification for the change is to redirect to a more promoting rather than protecting and insular and borders type of mentality. But I was just curious if there were sort of quantitative measures that you could you could track to see whether the change in terminology actually had a profound impact on people's perception.
Well, this was largely a political debate. The original name of the portfolio was indeed Protecting the European Way of Life. Mm. As I explained, the security, which is also the focus of your podcast, was a major component of this portfolio. So the idea was also to put an emphasis on that aspect. Mm. But the political debate that was provoked is the link between protecting the European way of life and the policies around migration and asylum. Mm. And there could be misunderstandings that could be created that by protecting the European way of life, you would exclude rather than include. I think the original intention of our president when she proposed this portfolio was, in fact, the whole concept of inclusion rather than exclusion. But following a political debate at the very beginning of this mandate, we found a compromise in the term promoting the European way of life, promoting for everyone who chooses it, but also promoting our European way of life in the global sense of the world, so for the rest of the world, because we believe that this is about values and our principles that we are very proud of and that the underlying foundation of the European Union. So I think everybody is more comfortable with the term promoting than protecting. And that does not mean we will not protect what needs to be protected. And that includes the public health right now. And I think this is by far now the biggest objective we have due to the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I think there we will see that people will focus more on the protecting side of things. Mm. But we will continue to also promote, of course, because we continue to work on other areas. So I don't think about whether this shift from protecting to promoting has made any difference. What I know is that real life has shown us that there is now a very good reason to protect also the European way of life. You need to protect it from the pandemic.
So let's go into the pandemic. The sleepless nights and days that you're currently undergoing. What are you doing? What's your department doing? What kind of steps are you taking? I'll preface this question by mentioning to the audience that I will put show notes a mission letter that the European Union released from Margarita Skinas, who you are the chief of staff of, discussing the European way of life and some of the issues faced at the moment. So what are you doing? Give us a rundown of your day-to-day at the moment.
So first things first, in the European Union, we have this pretty particular construction of 27 countries today that come together in what we call an internal market. And this is where our responsibility lies, ensuring and preserving this internal market of 27 autonomous and sovereign member states. Let us not forget, the European Union is not a federal system. Mm. So our work focuses on ensuring that during the pandemic, we do two things. First, we ensure the internal market continues to offer what is necessary for every country to fight against the pandemic, and I will come to more detail around that. Mm. And the second thing is to play a role when it comes to public health. In this latter, actually, our role is a bit limited because when the fathers of the European Union created the European Union, they decided that when it comes to public health, every country is responsible for itself. So the powers we have at European level are quite small. We have powers to coordinate, but we cannot impose on member states, what kind of policies they should follow for public health.
Interesting. Okay.
What is very interesting is that every time there has been a crisis, member states do turn to us asking for more
coordination. What do we do?
Of course.
Yeah.
Because we have a European Union policy on borders.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, the European Union is borderless.
Yeah.
It's seamless. You cross from France to Belgium without any idea that you have done so.
Yeah.
It's usually a text message by your operator that tells you you have just crossed to another country. Today, because of the pandemic, all of a sudden we see border controls.
Yeah.
We see places that were abandoned, the old sort of, you know, authorities, border authorities, border control authorities, police authorities, popping up again.
Reinstating, yeah.
This is something we have to manage because we have built for decades. We are celebrating on 9th of May, on Saturday, we're celebrating Europe Day. So we are celebrating the fact that we didn't have borders. Now all of a sudden we have borders. So this needs management. And that comes to us. Because the day the pandemic hit, and I will start with that as to what we are doing, we had to make sure that because there were borders all of a sudden, because of public health reasons, governments were trying to protect their citizens from more infection from other countries, we still needed trucks to pass, people to cross the borders, because the European Union, there are things that are produced in one country as raw material, and then they have to be transferred to another.
Yeah.
And that includes medical supplies, protective equipment, doctors, nurses. So people and commercial activities without which every country would be incapable of managing the pandemic even at, in their own ground. So we created corridors for the trucks to pass. We created a coordination mechanism so that we know where there are border controls and where there are not. We started also helping member states deal with medical shortages, ensuring we have a joint approach where we have somewhere a stockpile of protective equipment so that those that are short can draw from that. Because the immediate reaction of everyone was to protect at national level. We went back 50 years in the mindset because of the pandemic. And we had to save us from that because it can have a huge impact. If I give you an example, we started seeing export bans from countries. There are countries that export masks.
Yep.
Because they're produced there. So you had Italy that was in a major crisis where you live.
Yeah.
And they were ordering masks and there was an export ban by governments of other countries in the European Union, not allowing them to obtain them.
Yeah.
This is illegal in the internal market. It is actually illegal. So we have to step in to help governments work around that. And governments expect us to do it. It is incredible how much governments have come together to work with us. In the last 11 weeks since the lockdowns started, we actually have every week ministerial meetings of all ministers, interior, health, on a very regular basis. So every week, sometimes twice a week, where we try to coordinate. When it came to closing down schools at the very beginning of the crisis, well, as soon as the pandemic was announced, we had ministers discuss with each other, how do you deal with it? Because again, there you need to have a common approach. So we were not prepared to coordinate and we had to do it as we were going by the crisis and as we were managing the crisis. So that's what has been keeping us busy. And we are a regulator, so we do that through laws. So every day we issue laws, recommendations, etc. We have to change also our current laws. For instance, our current internal market rules do not allow governments to just try to sort of give money to companies and to anyone in need because the economy has stopped. We have stated rules, as we call them, which are there to ensure that there is competition in Europe between companies so that no government can just pump up one company and then the others die in the others and then they become a monopoly. So.
Yep.
But now governments need to give state aid. So we introduced brand new rules that allow governments to save small companies, save entrepreneurs. So we are also recreating ourselves to adapt in a temporary manner. I don't think we will go back to our principles. So we have been trying to adapt the European way of life to the current reality. That takes a lot of regulatory work, a lot of talking with the member states, but also with others. For instance, every week we have a meeting with the pharmaceutical companies the medical devices companies, those that produce the protective equipment, so that we make sure we know where the shortages are, where the needs are, where we need to help. So it's not just about governments. It's also about those that help manage the crisis.
Yeah,
we are in contact with the operators about these tracing applications that may help us control the spread of the virus and how to do that in a way that, again, does not undermine our values.
Let's pick on that one, because that's another hot topic at the moment. Another, many governments around the world are choosing either to develop their own or not develop or get assistance from Apple and Google. What's the European stance, and how does that spill over? There is a document that I will put in the show notes just as a preface as well, which was a very well-constructed document by the European Union outlining some of this. But if you can explore that.
Yes. So this document actually is about how to ensure that all these applications that are being produced in the market respect our fundamental values of privacy and security. Because the problem with this kind of applications is that they're all about collecting personal and sensitive data. And we know from our previous experience, and that's why we introduced all these laws in Europe about privacy and data protection, that our citizens are very mindful of that. So we tried to create a framework within which operators and government could ensure that they pick up this data, that people offer this data, but without going further than what is necessary to manage the pandemic, because this data is very precious. So, for instance, that this data would become anonymized, that it would not be traced back to you, so that the companies and the operators profile you and then they make money out of you for other users that are irrelevant to the management of the coronavirus crisis. So this is what this recommendation is all about. Admittedly, we do not see a very large pickup of the idea of tracing applications in Europe. It's still at its very beginning. We think that it can help governments manage mostly the spread of viruses by region so that they can make sure they have the necessary medical response. This is where it is important. It's not just about informing you whether you've been in contact with someone, but it helps government ensure they have the necessary
to direct and allocate
resources.
Budget.
Exactly, yeah. And they can move them from one region to another. If you take as an example the map of France or even Italy, you will see that you have three types of spread. You have some areas where the spread is less and then where it continues and it's quite strong and it's still going up. So with the tracing app, you can direct your medical resources or get help from another country. By way of example of the European way of life, Germany accepted patients from France, from the regions that are close to its borders, because it was easier to transfer them to German hospitals and to have them taken care of there and in sufficient capacity rather than move them to the north of France or to the south of France, etc. So this is, again, where we are working on making sure that things work. So this was our philosophy behind this recommendation that I'm happy you will publish, because I think it's good for people to know.
Yeah.
It's a recommendation that follows the approach we took for the 5G network security, if you recall that long discussion we had before.
Yep. Yeah, it is a never-ending conversation. In Australia, there's been a particular approach, and 3 days ago I had a discussion with a Professor Katina Michaels, fantastic lady from University of Wollongong, and one of her former students, who's another friend of mine, Ed, Edward Farrell, and we were discussing first of all, the efficacy of the app itself. Australia's app is based on, you know, they took some of the code from the Singaporean model and then built on top of it. At least in Australia, it's a completely different case to Europe, but at least in Australia, there has been a rather poor track record of examples which have been brought up in the public sphere of very poorly implemented technology initiatives done by the Digital Transformation Agency. And so therefore, their attempt with this one and their choices were, look, in my mind, have been as pretty much in the main as good as they can be. But then the question becomes, is it a knee-jerk reaction to adopt these types of content tracing apps in the first place when there are still restrictions and limitations on the accuracy of Bluetooth. Certainly, there's a big privacy and surveillance issue with the location portion. And even the third question is, if everything is sound and everything's up to speed, then if this is a government-endorsed initiative, then there are certain areas of government which wants to hold true to that, but there are always other, and there should be other parts of the government creating the necessary tension and pull and push, which want to use that data to, for intelligence means. And this is, I think, where the provision, which I read in the EU document, it actually laid it out quite well. And I wonder, just as an aside question, do you know of any other cases or comparative cases of different nation states whose model differs a lot from the European process?
On the tracing app?
Yeah.
I think that in this whole, in the whole management of the pandemic, we have seen that we all realize we don't have the tools necessary to deal with it. Mm. No part of the world was prepared. Nobody. So it is very important that we create tools that may or may not prove useful. So for the tracing apps, for us, it was about laying the ground that no matter what you do in Europe, it has to respect the fundamental values and the laws.
Yeah, and then you can try the different development of tech, even though we don't really know what we're doing. Exactly. Yeah.
Then we see.
Yeah.
It may not prove the panacea, but we have it.
Yeah.
It may be more relevant when the virus will start going down.
Yeah.
And it may be more relevant once we want to create certain statistics. But let's see. I think that we have to give it some time.
Yeah.
I would add also the worry about security. And if you allow me there, I would pass to another challenge we have had during the COVID times, which is the impact on security issues, because we have seen very interesting information on the kind of cyber attacks that we have had in the European Union and possibly other places, and also the rise of cybercrime that has been unbelievably high.
Yeah.
So if you add to that having this massive personal and sensitive data through tracing apps, I think the challenge becomes immense. Huh?
Mm.
So it's also a little bit about that. I think governments are a bit conscious of the fact that they can only have so many fronts of security to manage during a crisis.
Yeah.
The resources they have.
Yeah, and this is, it's a very horrible challenge faced by some. Yesterday, I was in a webinar presentation with the International Telecommunications Union, and there was another former guest, Neil Walsh, who's coming back on the podcast again to chat all things cyber and COVID in a couple of weeks' time. But the instances of domestic abuse, child abuse, violence, and also popping up of different streaming on the dark net associated with those types of abuses has risen dramatically. And then not to mention the comparatively more benign, but of course not more benign, criminality and ransomware. Because again, now ransomware might halt operations and severely impact businesses. And if it's a company where only dollars and cents are concerned, then I guess you can look at it with the silver lining that no one died. That's not the case anymore, because now check hospitals, you know, who are accepting people and patients who require those hospitals to function properly, and they're hit by ransomware from opportunistic criminals with the gall to criminalize efforts during a pandemic. It's wild out there. So.
It is. We have seen a rise on ransomware campaigns, denial of service attacks, and then huge rise on phishing campaigns and cybercrime in terms of targeting teleconference applications, distance learning applications. So cyber criminals go straight to the heart of how we have adapted our life because of the pandemic. Now, so far, so good. So far, we have not seen any system collapse. It shows you that the infrastructure we have put in place at the European level works. I can also tell you that the information we receive is truly very well coordinated. So countries also work a lot with each other. And there, Europol, the European agency, has done an incredible job. And what you may also want to post with all the documents without wanting to overburden
They prefer listening, not reading.
It's a fantastic Well, it is a regular report, just to point people, and then if they follow it, they follow it on Twitter, they can go on the website. Yeah. Europol issues a very regularly monitoring of the pandemic impact on organized crime, terrorism, and cybercrime.
Yeah.
And I think there you see the fantastic things that police is doing, also at European level, working together to tackle this. But it is an extra challenge we have to adapt to.
Yeah.
And something, again, where our work is stepping up because we need to coordinate. And we have also our European Agency for Cybersecurity, ENISA, yeah. that is monitoring all those large infrastructure attacks. So, for instance, the Czech attack against hospitals was something that was discussed also with other countries. Mm. And the lessons learned by the Czech hospitals were this way disseminated to all the other countries' infrastructure managers to take measures. So this is the fabulous and wonderful thing about the European internal market.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a new, it's even an elevated new world with the types of international collaborations that that are happening. CTI League is one that I can think of, which is sharing threat intelligence information, which otherwise would have been used as a profit center for different companies. They're now opening that up to aid organizations in need, alongside bodies like ENISA and alongside bodies like the Cyber Peace Institute, for example. You mentioned Europol, a guy called Stefan, who I had a couple of conversations with, is now running a Cyber Peace with a similar kind of focus on emergency response to vulnerable nations and to vulnerable populations. So jumping into another area, which is not in my wheelhouse because it's not so much the cyber portion, but it is certainly part of your wheelhouse, and it's the block, it's security, and also migration flows. Now, I'm interested how this particular crisis that we're going through has impacted some of the, you know, some of the ability to monitor and manage migration flows. What kind of comments do you have there?
So obviously the border controls introduced by countries have also an impact on migration management.
Yep.
Migration flows have, of course, diminished during the crisis in some parts of our borders, not everywhere.
Mm.
What we have done is, again, as part of our coordination work and making sure that the laws are properly implemented, is we have issued also guidance to governments as to how to continue processing asylum requests during the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So how to ensure social distancing measures, how to put in infrastructure to carry out by distance asylum interviews, so that those that are already in Europe and are waiting their asylum request processing do not have to wait too long, and that these processes are not hampered. Then, of course, we are still managing migration flow. Yep. So the arrival of migrants, and this continues regularly with the same challenges also and problems as before,
yep.
but we see less. Of course, now this may change in the Mediterranean with the weather also improving. We will have to see what happens.
Yeah.
So we are very, very mindful that the management of migration and asylum issues does not stop. So this is something that we continue working with the governments on. And there are also certain things that have not stopped and, in fact, are very are a big pride of what we have been doing. I'd like to mention those. For instance, the relocation of unaccompanied minors in Europe. Right before the crisis, we had achieved an agreement between a huge number of unaccompanied minors that remain in the islands in Greece and a number of countries that were willing to receive them after several calls, not only by the Greek government, but also the European Union. And we have managed to relocate these minors during the crisis with special flights that were made for them and with governments taking up the quarantine necessary measures for the kids that arrive in a new country. So we had at least 10 such relocations in 10 different countries to this date. So as you see, we try to overcome also the challenges of the pandemic to make sure that the good things we can do about the migration situation continue.
Okay. We're moving towards the end, toward the end of the discussion. Is there anything else you want to add about the about what you see or what is on the table to be achieved over the next 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months?
So the most important thing we have done is something that was quite publicized last Monday, and this was this pledging initiative for the vaccines, medicines, and diagnostics for the coronavirus. This was a pledging event that took place on the 4th of May, on Monday. It was chaired by the president of the European Commission. The vice president I work for was in charge of coordinating this effort, so I had the pleasure, really, and quite a tough job to work in that direction. We managed to gather 7.4 billion for something that is probably the only way to manage this crisis. So the idea behind this global initiative is to make sure that we step up research towards the vaccine and the diagnostics, the tests, as well as the medicines, the therapeutic methods for managing coronavirus, and make sure that once they become available, they are distributed in a fair and equitable way. This is a huge geopolitical issue. In fact, it touches upon security. Because imagine the race for the vaccine, the first one who finds it, and using it as leverage to rule the world. So it's very important, and we were very honored to be approached by a number of partners who have the right resources, both for the research and the deployment side. Because once we have the vaccine, it should be available not only for those who can buy it, but also the vulnerable countries. So we're thinking Africa, we're thinking Latin America, certain Asian countries. We need to make sure it is available to the whole world in a fair manner. So this is a very big initiative. That's why everybody came in. We had forces united from across the world. So this is something that's only starting today. It is the beginning of a process. And that will go on for another year, because we all know there won't be another way out of this. The only way is to have tests available for people to know whether they have it, whether they have antibodies, etc., therapeutics for those who get infected, and most importantly, vaccines, so that we can actually get rid of this.
Yeah, and then that comes back to a cyber question in part, because protecting research centers which are working on the development of the vaccine is a huge thing, because there are certainly a lot of interested parties looking to peek under the covers. So we'll see how it develops over the next week. Despina, it's an absolute pleasure to have you, as always, on the podcast. Anything else that you want to add, or you're happy to wrap up and...
Okay. Thank you, Nick. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure. I think we touched upon critical issues that are in the heart of the European business today. And I thank you for giving us the opportunity to share them with your listeners.
Absolutely. As I said, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.